All right, as promised this morning, we'll be in John, the 11th chapter, looking at the story of Lazarus. This story received some criticism from the really critical scholars who like to criticize things. That's probably obvious, I guess, from their names. That it's odd that a story of this magnitude is not found in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. And I'll agree, it is odd that a story of this magnitude is not in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. However, as we mentioned this morning, each of the gospel accounts contains some kind of resurrection story, whether it's the many saints rising up at the crucifixion in Matthew, the rising up of Jairus' daughter in Mark chapter 5, or the widow of Nain's son in Luke. All the gospels testify in some way, though differently, to the power of Christ over life and over death in his lifetime. In preparation for the story of the resurrection, where all the Gospels end up. So it doesn't completely surprise me that John is the only one that tells this story at length. John actually does a lot of things the other guys don't do as far as telling stories. We're going to try to do this like I've done the others, where we'll do a little bit of explanation up front and then leave plenty of time for some discussion of the text as we go through it. We're going to start in verses 1 through 16 of John chapter 11. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister Lazarus. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, Let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and you are going there again? Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he meant taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, or your translation may have Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, Let us also go, that we may die with him. So a couple things that are very similar in this passage to last week's gospel story in chapter 9, the man born blind. In both cases, there's a question about why is this happening, or why has this happened, or what are you going to do about it? And in both cases, Jesus responds with, God's glory is going to come out of this event. God's glory comes out of the man's blindness, or in this case, the illness of Lazarus will lead to the glory of God. And in both cases, he makes some kind of comment about, we work when it's day. So there's an appropriate time for work and labor. These tasks are set before us now to do. And they're both a little bit cryptic. And we kind of worked our way through chapter 9, 3 through 5 last week. But they're both just a little bit cryptic. Does Jesus mean that this particular event was put here so that Christ could do something? Or does he mean events of this sort happen so that God's glory can be worked in them? What does he mean by day? Is he talking about himself, that he, the Messiah, has a limited amount of time before the cross, and so now it's time to do work? Could be. Or is he making a more general statement? So they're a little bit confusing, to the point that it's clear the disciples have no idea what he's saying in this passage, and especially when he gets around to, well, our friend Lazarus is asleep, which Jesus has used on other occasions to describe death. The passage I mentioned a moment ago, Mark chapter 5, Jairus' daughter, he says, she's not dead, she's sleeping. And the physicians say, pretty dead to us. I think we know what death is. And he says, rise up, and she does. So death, for him, is a way of describing, or sleep is a way of describing death, while also teaching something about how temporary and powerless it is. Death is scary because death is permanent. Well, sleep's not that scary. I'll wake up from sleep. And so he likes to call death sleep, to give you a sense that this is temporary. This is an obstacle to be overcome. Two issues are at work in the early part of the story. One of them becomes the more important one. The first problem is, will Jesus the healer heal his friend? Now that is all the way through all 45 verses. Again and again, someone says, whether it's Martha or the Jewish people that are there, this man is known to be a healer, a miracle worker, not just a doctor. He's not a physician. He is a miracle worker. He's healing people in ways no one has ever heard of before. Surely, if he wanted to heal his friend, he could do that. So that question comes up all the way throughout. And I think it's actually kind of an important question. Trying to decide how deep into the pool we want to go. But why doesn't God just heal everybody? I mean, just take Jesus out of the picture for a moment. Why does God have the power to heal illness? He does. Does God have the power to prevent death? He does. So why doesn't he just do that? So what I'm trying to point out is we have the same questions of God that they have more directly for Jesus. And so part of me thinks that Jesus' answer about himself, why doesn't Jesus do this, is also kind of part of God's answer to our other question. There is a reason that some of these bad things happen. Maybe not a specific reason, God put it there to make a point, but to allow for something else, some glory of God to take place, certain illnesses take place. It's a little bit tricky to work through it, but I do think there's a connection between why doesn't Jesus the healer heal his friend, and why doesn't God heal everyone? Or to ask it based on this morning's sermon, if God can raise the dead, why hasn't he already? Why is anybody still dead? Right. So we could ask the same question. Evidently, if you look at Jesus' answer, there's something about timing involved. There's something about glory involved. And it's a little bit cryptic. And that may be the correct answer. The second question that is asked here in the beginning and then disappears until the end of the chapter is, will Jesus go back to Judea and face danger? So last time Jesus had been in Judea, things had not gone particularly well. Jesus' ministry is sometimes divided into 3 years. There's a year of inauguration where he's introduced to the people, a year of popularity where everyone likes him and he can do no wrong, a year of conflict where we lead to the cross, and this is year 3. There has been trouble in other places he has been, including Judea. So the question is he going to go back? And so for them, the disciples, they're not even asking the question, why doesn't Jesus heal his friend? They assume they know the answer. The answer is clearly that it would be dangerous for him to go do that. Well, that's going to be turned upside down when Jesus goes anyway after Lazarus is dead. So now they really want to know, okay, well, if fear wasn't the problem, why didn't you go when he was still alive? And then one more word of comment before I just open for a brief bit of questions. I do love verse 16, poor Thomas. What's the rest of Thomas's name? Doubting Thomas, right? And it's from John's Gospel. At the end of John's Gospel, Thomas says, I will not believe unless I put my hand in the side and feel the prints in it. He wants to see it for himself, which, in all fairness, if I were Thomas's lawyer, this is what I'd tell you. All Thomas wanted was the same thing that his other disciples had already had. The other disciples had already seen Jesus and inspected him, and Thomas says, well, I'm not going to believe it till I do. Anyway, Thomas, we remember as being the doubter. This verse reminds us he doesn't lack courage, right? He doesn't think this is going to end well at all. Maybe he's still doubting, but he has no doubt about where he's going to be, right? Let us go with him that we may die with him, right? Conviction right there. So why don't we remember this verse about Thomas? He would get to much better, what would we call him? Believing Thomas. Brave Thomas. I don't know. Oh, well. Okay, question for discussion, unless you have one specifically. I was going to ask you if anybody had any insightful comments into what Jesus is saying in verses 11 through 15. After saying these things, said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he meant taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, this is the bit I want to know about, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. Let us go to him. Why is Jesus glad that he was not there to prevent his friend's death? Randy?
I think so that he could show his power. If he was there, then people would be healing like he'd done everybody else.
Yeah.
This is a step above, you know, raising a dead person.
So what we're going to see throughout the entire, I think you're on the right track, throughout this whole chapter, the people we meet in chapter 11 believe that Jesus can heal people who are sick. That question is not up for debate. But that's as far as they're willing to go. And so, had Jesus been there and healed Lazarus, it would have been a wonderful testament to something they already believe in, that Jesus can heal sick people. What's going to happen instead is something that no one could have anticipated, apparently. A step further. That's one reading of it. Lenora, was that a... Yeah, the widow's son, we're still carrying him out. He hasn't been buried yet. Jairus' daughter is still lying in the bed. She hasn't even been moved from the room. This person has been dead 4 days. Completely, this is closer to Ezekiel's dry bones, right? This is further along. This person is completely dead. Now, the others, I think, were completely dead too. But you get the point, that it's more emphatic that this person is beyond saving. And no one thinks otherwise. So that this does seem to raise a little further the stakes of what happens next. Any other quick thoughts on that before we move ahead? Because I think you're on the right track there. Good. Let's look in verses 17 through verse 27. I'm going to let you answer some questions on this one. I'm going to be quiet a little bit after I read it. Verse 17 through 27, we get the story of Martha. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? And she said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. So it's an interesting conversation where statements are made and responses are made, and it's not clear if they're even having the same conversation. Is she answering his question? What is he asking? So here are my questions for you on this one. What do we think about Martha? Does Martha believe in Jesus, actually? I think that one's going to be an easy one. Okay. Does Martha believe what Jesus is saying to be true? Does Martha understand what Jesus is saying? Or in other words, in what way is Martha limiting her belief in Jesus? So by the time you get to verse 27, it's evident that there's some disconnect between what Jesus is asking and what she's responding with. And so what I'm asking you is, where's the breakdown? Which part of this is she not convicted of? And which part is she maybe expressing faith in? You can take a shot at any of those if you'd like. Jim, go ahead. And that's probably where I would land in that series of questions, is that she believes all the things that she says. She believes in the resurrection. She believes Jesus, the Son of God. What she doesn't seem to understand is that he now is what he says he will be. That there is an immediacy to his claim, what she doesn't pick up on or ignores. So, for example, she says, if you'd been here, you would not have died. No debate there. I'm going to come back to verse 22 in a minute. Your brother will rise again, verse 23, and Martha says, well, I know in the resurrection on the last day. So, from what we know about Judaism up to this point in history, Jewish people, other than the Sadducees, believed in a bodily resurrection. But it was kind of a periphery doctrine. They believed in it, but it wasn't. If you'd ask a Jewish person, tell me about what does it mean to be Jewish, they might not have ever gotten around telling you about the resurrection. It wasn't a doctrine that they thought was central. They believed someday, one of these days, that'll happen. Which kind of plays into this morning's sermon. Yeah, one of these days, dry bones. Okay, if God says so. So when Jesus says, do you believe he could be raised up? She says, sure, one of these days. Seems to be the sense of her response. I believe that as much as any Jewish person does. One of these days, God will get around to it. Jesus says, I am. Now she says, resurrection on the last day. Jesus says, right now in front of you is walking, talking resurrection power. Do you believe that? And there again, she comes back and kind of hedges it a little bit. She says, yes. Because, I mean, who would tell Jesus, no, I don't believe a word you just said. Of course, he says, yes, I believe it, but then she changes what he said. He says, do you believe I am the resurrection and the life? She says, I believe you are the Christ, the one who is coming into the world. And conveniently leaves off a bit that he actually asked about. So she believes a great deal about Jesus, more than a lot of people at this time believed. Okay, we would call her a believer. She is, in a sense, a disciple. She is a believer in Jesus, believes he's Messiah, he's Christ. Even he is the Son of God, and that he has power, but she seems to have reservations about saying the actual words he says, that present tense, I am walking, talking, resurrection power, not far off, what's one of our hymns, whispering hope, you know, not some distant hope, but we're standing right in front of you, this could happen right now kind of power. The only caveat I'd put on that, Jim, because I think that's the right read, it is verse 22, bugs me a little bit. I don't know what she means when she says, even now that her brother's dead. Even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. So if you wanted to cut her some slack, you could say that's her way of saying, I do believe you could raise him from the dead. She doesn't seem to be really committed to that as the conversation goes on. I think what it might probably mean, hear that, might probably, that's about as sure as I get on that one, might probably mean, is that this has not caused me to doubt you. So because Jesus didn't heal my brother, well, maybe I don't believe he can do anything anymore. No, she says, I still believe, if I brought you a sick person right now, you could heal him. Even now, I still believe you can do all the things you've been doing. I just don't think she has resurrection in mind. Because you just follow the conversation. Jesus is clearly bringing up resurrection, and she's clearly not. She just doesn't want to go there. I still believe God would do whatever you ask. Do you believe on the resurrection? Well, I still believe you're the Christ. You see. So what I think we might learn from this as Christians in our time is that we play the same game with Jesus, where Jesus is making demands of us as to what we believe and how we act with regards to those beliefs. And we say, we believe you're the Christ. He says, do you believe I'm the Lord of your life and of every choice and value that you have? We believe you're the Son of God. Do you believe I'm the Lord of your wallet? We believe you're the Christ. Do you believe that I'm the Lord of your sexual ethics and your commitment to your job and to your commitment to your family and to everything? We believe you're the Christ, right? We keep coming back. We believe certain things about Jesus, but then when he pushes it a little further in the Gospels, we recoil as well and say, well, we believe in all the other stuff. Right? We, like the Jewish people, would have been much happier with a tame Jesus who was here to be a Messiah and throw out the Romans and maybe save some souls. That would be great for us. A Jesus who wants to tell us how to live is a little bit more frightening than that. Thoughts or questions on this section? Or on any of the questions on the board?
Ben?
Jim? Try again. Yep.
In Christ, and we believe, and yet we want it on our terms sometimes. We want it on our timeline, and so I see that kind of with her. Well, if you'd have been here, yeah. Lazarus, my brother, would not have died. And so she was kind of questioning why he wasn't there to do what she knew he could do, that he could heal him.
That's interesting, Jim, because I think I could make that point on both ends of the question that when it comes to the healing, she was ready for something immediate, and apparently Jesus was not because he didn't get there. On the terms of resurrection, she was willing to wait. She really wasn't expecting God to do anything, and Jesus is just as frustrated that she's willing to wait. Why don't you ask and let's do it now? What, do you believe it right now? And I think you're right that we do that in prayer. But sometimes we get frustrated when God doesn't do, you know, wonder-working power right in front of us. And then sometimes we give up and say, well, God will make it all right someday. And I wonder if God doesn't get frustrated that we ask so little of him. Yeah. Zach?
In their time, numbers were very significant. The amount of days that he was in the tomb was 4 days.
Yeah.
And I almost read this as, okay, Jesus early on said, Lazarus is sick, let's go. He takes his time. And when he shows up, Martha is, I know you were coming. I'm upset you weren't here earlier. You could have done something. Because the 3 days had passed, which signaled he's dead. And Jesus, I think, showed up after 3 days because he is dead, which makes us more powerful.
I've been trying to verify it at some kind of document, and I can't find anything to prove it, but I've read repeatedly, and I've heard preachers say it, Lenora, so you know it's true. I've read repeatedly that Jewish people believed that for the three-day period, the spirit was not as far off. And then after the third day, on your way. I've heard that repeatedly from commentaries, and I've not seen any of them documented. But it seems to be a consensus that Jewish people, well, even in our culture, do we still have wakes sometimes? I mean, the history of the wake is the idea that we're going to wait and see for a few days or a day. And that's even in certain cultures in American culture. I've never been to a wake, but you know, it's the same sort of thing that happens. So for 3 days, no one thinks he's alive, but We'll stick around and see. Fourth day is time for mourners. I mean, this is over. Or as she's going to say in the next passage, he's going to start smelling. He's getting ripe. Decay has set in. So any hope that we've just misunderstood, we're past that. So, yeah, I do think the four-day reference is significant for something like that. Although, as I said, I'm still struggling to document somebody who can prove to me that's what Jewish people thought. I've just heard it from five or six different sources, and none of them can tell me where they got it. I hear that internet's pretty good, so we'll see if it's out there somewhere. Okay, well, let's move ahead then and get to Mary. Now, the interaction with Mary is different than with Martha. Let me read verse 28 to 37. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?" Okay. So, interesting that there are some strong similarities between Mary and Martha. They both make almost identical statements, right? It's not that Mary says something much more forthcoming and faithful. Both of them say, "If you had been here, he would not be dead." And then just to amen that, the crowd, some of them at least, are back behind saying the same thing. Surely this man who's, well, we read chapter 9, right? Man born blind, if he can do that, couldn't he have saved this man? Couldn't that have happened? So that seems to be going on. So my questions are, is there anything that you see different about Mary as opposed to Martha? How is Jesus' response different to Mary than it was to Martha? Even though they said basically the same thing. And then if you want to tread softly into speculative territory, you can try to tell me why Jesus weeps. We'll get to 37 later. Any thoughts? Let's start with Mary. Why and how is Jesus' response different to Mary than it is Martha? He seems almost frustrated with Martha. Does he seem frustrated with Mary? Lenore?
Mary. Much more compassionate with Mary.
Okay. Compassion? Lenore?
Mary was grieving openly.
Okay. Yeah, I think you're exactly right, and in both cases, that what you're seeing is Jesus responds to human people like a human person does. And this is appropriate. I think the Bible teaches us this in church situations, that there's not a one-size-fits-all response to every situation, that you look at the people involved. Martha was asking very direct questions, and he gives her some pretty direct answers. Mary is weeping. She is in a different place in her grief. Those of you that, I'm guessing most of you, have lost someone dear to you, so think back for a moment if you would. When you were in the depth of your grief, did you want someone to give you an intellectual answer about the resurrection? At that particular moment? You're really not interested. At that particular moment, you don't want an intellectual, "Well, let me explain a doctrine that will help you out with this," right? There isn't, we take classes on this at college, you know, okay, preachers, what do we say when people are grieving? And the professor says, nothing. That there isn't a right word. That's why it's so difficult for everybody who does that. It's very difficult because there isn't a right word. There isn't a right thing to say when a person is in that state of grief. And Mary is. She is openly grieving. Not to say that Martha wasn't sad, but she's having a conversation. Mary is just in tears. And so how does Jesus respond to her tears? With tears. Once upon a time, I thought I needed to figure out exactly why Jesus wept. I was very curious. I thought, now, he's about to raise up Lazarus. Why doesn't he just chuckle and say, "Oh, what do you know? Let me show you." Well, why is he weeping at all? And I had all kinds of elaborate answers about why I thought that was. You want my new answer? I think Jesus wept because he was sad. Real profound, huh? She's sad, and he's sad that she's sad. It doesn't matter that he is divine. It does not matter that he knows that Lazarus will come back from the dead. His friend is dead. His friends are weeping. And he's sad. He would be a cold, inhuman person if he couldn't share in that compassion and that sympathy. We wouldn't want to pray in the name of a person. This goes back to Hebrews. We have not a high priest who cannot be touched by the feelings of our infirmities. We wouldn't want a high priest who, in our moment of despair, says, "Ben, let me give you some doctrinal tenets that you need to adhere to." We want one who knows and sympathizes. We have lots of songs about this. Does Jesus care when my heart... We have songs about this that we sing. We sing them at funerals for a reason. Because we want to know, does Jesus care? And this passage, I think, is just a simple statement of, yeah, he does. He's very sad that she's sad. He's very sad that someone he cared about died, even though he anticipates something grand to come. David?
I think the emotional side of humanness is another reason Jesus had to come to earth.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's important to know that about God. I mean, sure, this is his human quality, but he's also showing us in human tears something we'd like to know about God. Does God sympathize with us? And I think the very human tears of Jesus show us a little bit about the very divine compassion of God, that he's not immune to us. He does care about us. And he doesn't want us to hurt. He doesn't want us to feel sad or sorrow. And death is as sad as it gets, especially in John chapter 11, because we haven't had Sunday morning yet. We haven't had the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We haven't had something that changes the way we view death. This is very sad. Of course it is. And he shares in that. Randy?
Yeah. Yeah, it shows that God's compassion too. That you just look in Revelations, that it says God will wipe away our tears. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I think there's two answers to personal tragedy and the suffering that we go through. One is that God wants to make it right in the end, but that God is not far from us in the meantime. He's not just leaving us, "Well, I'll get back to you fellas later," right? It's not that distant attitude. And Jesus is the sign of that. That's really important for me because that helps when I do talk to people from time to time who are going through something difficult. One of the things they want, if they ask me, if they don't ask me, I don't talk about it, but if they ask me, why is this happening? Why does God let this happen? One of my answers is I don't have all the answers to that. I know that Jesus shared in the same grief you're going through. And so whatever his reason for letting things go on down here that are awful, he also wants us to know that he cares about us deeply. And we see that in the tears of Christ, I think. Okay. Oh, Edwin, I'll go back just for you. Okay.
Not to discount anything that you said.
Uh-oh.
So
here we go.
Maybe reaching into that speculative realm that you were talking about.
Yeah.
When I read that he groaned in spirit and was troubled, do you think that, and I'm not in any way arguing that he wasn't, this was an emotional thing, but do you think there was also maybe some frustration?
Yeah.
Maybe that's not the right word, but maybe so. Frustration in that, again, Mary's response is the same as Martha's, in that, don't you realize that I am the resurrection and the life? Both of their responses were focused on, if you'd have been here, he wouldn't die. So maybe some frustration in seeing both of their mindsets the same, and the people that were with them the same, instead of having that faith or that knowledge that this guy has resurrection power, he can raise my brother.
I'll go a little ways with you in that direction. how did Mary and Martha look at Jesus? When he met their eyes, I know the question they said, did they feel betrayed that a person who had time to heal every peasant and beggar in Judea and Galilee and Samaria hadn't made time for Lazarus? And I wonder if they felt some of that and were trying to kind of hold that back. And he picks up on not just the grief, but their frustration with him. They're not expecting him to raise the dead. They feel a little like, as they both said, could have done something if he'd been here on time. And the people in the crowd are thinking the same thing. So I think it's reasonable to think he's also frustrated by that, for sure, that no one is actually expecting him to do what he's about to do, including the people who don't believe and the people who do believe. That's the sad part. To put it in a modern, people in the church and people outside the church have the same doubt. How frustrating would that be to Jesus? His disciples and the not disciples doubt him in the same way. Yeah. So I would go that far. So yeah, I think there's some frustration there. I used to speculate even more, and now, see, I'm not speculating. I'm just telling you what I used to speculate. Totally different. I used to speculate more that at the end of the chapter, this is the event that they decide, this guy's got to die. This man's got to be killed. And how upsetting would it have been for Jesus to know the greatest act of goodness in his ministry up to this point is the thing that people are going to hold on to and say, that person has to die. How tragic is that? So yeah, I can think of some other reasons he might have grieved. But I do think the point seems to be about the human compassion is probably that's the low-hanging fruit that I would say we could say that makes the most sense. Okay, let's finish this in my 2 minutes I've got left. We have to get Lazarus out of the tomb or it's a lousy story. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. But I said this on account of the people standing around that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! And the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. So the conversation that Martha had earlier, her comment, I think connects to 39 and 40. When she's still perfectly willing to believe, if you had come here, it would have been okay. What are you doing now? And Jesus says, do you believe, back to Edwin's point, do you believe what I said when I said you're going to see the glory of God? Take away the stone. The prayer is interesting. He openly admits in his prayer, I am praying this for other people's benefit. I never doubted that you would hear me. Other detail I think is important is in verse 43, it's Jesus' voice that calls Lazarus out of the tomb. Now, compare this. At Mount Carmel, the prophet prays in the presence of the prophets of Baal. The prophet of God prays and says, God, hear me and show that you're here and you can do great works. And the fire comes from heaven and consumes the sacrifice. So everyone knows the prophet prayed, but the power came from heaven. In the case of Jesus, Jesus prays to acknowledge the Father, but then it's his voice, it's his own authority that calls Lazarus out of the tomb. It's not a spotlight that comes down from heaven and, oh, an angelic chorus, right? Jesus himself utters the words and dead bodies respond. I think it's interesting that this story is somewhat different than the story of Jesus' resurrection later on. When I teach this or write it up, sometimes I'll make this a lowercase resurrection and Jesus is a uppercase R resurrection. His is in a different category in many ways, but still a significant prelude to that. Last comment, David, then it's all yours.
I think 4 days also has significance because verse 18 talks yeah. about people coming from Jerusalem. More people have
yeah. gathered. It's an audience.
See this.
Yep. And those same people go back and tell the high priest at the end of the chapter, and that's the end of that. Yep. Thanks for your attention and comments. Appreciate it. Good stuff.